Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Thanks so much for the warm Texas welcome, phrase I've become familiar with, especially in these chilly days. But I'm glad I made it in, and we'll see if I make it out. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm glad that there are so many young people and students in the room. And given all the turbulence in the world in the last couple of weeks, especially in the Middle East, it's worth sort of dispensing with just a standard run through this book and the arguments in it, because in some ways anyway it talks about just about everything. That's part of why it's called How to Run the World. But you know, I want to make sure to address some issues that are of particular significance for the younger generation. And there is an anecdote that I could begin with that's in the book, and it's about what happens at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, where they decided they're not going to do Model United Nations anymore. Now raise your hand if you've done Model UN. Sure, a lot of you. Yeah, there you go. Quite a few. So, you know, they said, you know, this just doesn't represent the world anymore. Sure, I want to get to play Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, or yes, I get to represent China. We've got all the money, you know, or it's fun to be, you know, to represent, you know, England or something like that in negotiations. You get to send more delegates. And they said, you know what? It just doesn't capture anymore. Kids today, when they do Model UN, they're saying, but I want to represent Bonin. You know, I want to represent Tom Friedman. I want to represent the head of the Shell Oil Company, or you know, something like that. Or you get to represent Osama bin Laden. So you know, all of these different players that are active in negotiating world politics, economics, and all sorts of trends as they're emerging today. Model UN doesn't exactly capture that. You only get to represent states. So at the College of William and Mary, they said, we're just not going to do this anymore. We're going to do a whole new kind of simulation. And you get to represent basically anyone you want. The punchline is that everyone gets to be a diplomat. And I think that's the most accurate representation of the world today. It's a world in which, because of globalization, everyone has their own diplomatic capacity. This was leaping out at me, Jim, when you just were talking about what reminded me of sister city programs. And that what you do that here from Dallas, lots of American cities do it. That's a form of diplomacy, when cities reach out to each other. And now they don't just do it by sending youth groups and citizens back and forth, but they also are building airline connections across these cities. You see more and more trade and commercial exchange going on. Cities are a big part of this transformation of diplomacy. You see cities really representing themselves, conducting their own foreign policies. And it was when I started to observe that happening, places like Dubai, or even Frankfurt, or Singapore, which is kind of a city-state, other places in the Middle East like Doha, you know, when you see cities reaching beyond the sort of country that they're within, that they are formally part of. And being a New Yorker, I see this all the time because of our mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who has his own intelligence service that goes overseas and conducts its own operations, has its own climate policy, its own financial investment strategy. Those things are done for New York. New York City has a foreign policy, right? So it was in observing all of that that I started to wonder how our picture of the world isn't complete when we think about just traditional diplomacy in the traditional world of the UN. What does the world really look like in terms of who calls the shots, and is there a system to bring it together? And there isn't yet, and that's the problem. That's the big gap, and that's the reason why I wanted to go back to diplomacy, because diplomacy is supposed to include everyone who is an authority, everyone who has money, resources, recognition, a following, and the capacity to represent themselves and say, these are my interests, this is what I want to do, this is how I'm going to push my agenda forward. And that reaches far beyond governments today, to cities, to companies, to NGOs, and so forth. And yet, again, what we have in this, in the 21st century, we're still stuck with those institutions like the United Nations and the World Bank that only represent a governance. And those are inadequate, and everyone has already, many people have stood at this podium and said, wow, we need a new global governance architecture, we need to revise the system that we have, we should expand the Security Council, right, bring in those rising powers. We need to change the voting structure in the International Monetary Fund, you've all heard that one before too. We need to have more of these climate summits, Copenhagen, Bali, Cancun, that have been going on. We need a universal legislation around climate change. You know, you've heard these silver bullet kinds of solutions. You've heard people talk about the G20. The G20 is much broader, it's more representative, it can fix the world's problems. It's the new steering committee for the world. You've heard that too. All of those things to me represent what I call old school global governance. I put them all in one category and I cast them aside. I want nothing to do with them because they are all incredibly narrowly focused on just the state. They're focused on just governance. The truth is that we have 200 countries in the world, which is almost four times more than when the UN was founded 60 years ago. And most of those states are actually post-colonial countries. Many of them are very frail, fragile, splintering, falling apart. Just look at Sudan. What has happened as of officially yesterday, the government of North Sudan recognized the secession of South Sudan. That's just one of dozens of examples of post-colonial states that are fragmenting, that are really experiencing suffering, a kind of entropy, falling apart in many ways. They're not coherent, competent governments who respect their people, who are democratic, who deserve, in a way, almost to have their voice be treated equally, which is why we have something called the responsibility to protect. That's a doctrine that says that the international community has an obligation to intervene in those countries to save their people from their government that may be waging genocidal campaigns against them, such as has been happening in Darfur and other places. So it's not adequate to simply say that in the 21st century we need to reform the United Nations, make it more fair and equitable, and then you'll have a perfect world. I think those silver bullets are precisely what lead you astray. They buy themselves time, and they raise our hopes, and then 5, 10 years later, we're once again disappointed when we have crisis after crisis after crisis. And that's exactly what we're living in, right? A world of crises. Why is it that we're in this world of crises? States failing, environmental decay, food prices spiking, economic turbulence and financial collapse. All of these things are happening. And where is our diplomacy? Where is the system that's supposed to be managing and anticipating and dealing with these crises? We don't have that system. We have just the traditional diplomacy of states, and it's not enough. It's not getting the job done. And we don't have a new architecture to replace it. And so that's why this book has the title that it does. It's ambitious, and some may think of it as a joke, but it's incredibly literal. The one-word answer to how you run the world is diplomacy. Running. When you say, I run a company, you're talking about operations, management, processes. A system that gets you beyond just, again, crisis management, ad hoc response, being caught off guard. And so what I was looking to do is to build a new diplomatic system, taking my cue almost from what those students at William and Mary are doing. How do you build something that is inclusive? How do you leverage the fact that in a globalized world, you have so many more actors out there with resources, with money, with capacity, who are willing to lend a hand? And so I wanted to look back to the time in history when the world was as turbulent feeling as it is today, when people had as much anxiety as we do today, when the world was multipolar, when the world wasn't just comprised of states. And that period of history did in fact exist. And as much as we all like to think that we're in an unprecedented era, this is totally unique in human history. In fact, the Middle Ages was, in some very striking ways, a bit like today's world, because it was multipolar. China, 1,000 years ago, Song Dynasty China was the most advanced civilization. It invented the printing press and gunpowder and paper money. And India's Chola Dynasty was a powerful naval empire that stretched all the way to Indonesia. Think about the caliphates. The Arab and Islamic world had centered around Cairo and Baghdad. They ruled from North Africa all the way to Central Asia. It was the West. It was the Holy Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire that were weak and defensive and feeling embattled. And that's in a way a bit like the Western civilization feels today. So because that world was multipolar, it's actually a very good role model or very good predecessor to the world we are in today. Because, of course, we all accept that China and India and the Persian Gulf countries and Brazil are becoming very powerful. They call their own shots. No one tells China what to do anymore, as I'm sure you've all noticed. India is becoming the same way, even Russia and Saudi Arabia and so forth. So you have to get used to that. The Middle Ages, again, was like that. We had the Crusades that fought out some of this, but again, to without resolution. And our conflicts of today, whether it is a financial dispute over currencies or about climate change and who's going to reduce their emissions, who's going to make commitments, you never find anyone winning. Look at the trade disputes in the world, in the WTO. No one really ever prevails. Everyone's suing each other, basically, about unfair trade practices. But there is no winner. America's not going to win. China's not going to win. The East is not going to replace the West. The Pacific is not going to replace the Atlantic. China is not going to replace America. It's going to be this very complicated, multipolar world that stretches like this for decades, if not more. And that's again, what characterized the Middle Ages. But at the same time, that was also when the world's first global intercontinental trading system was being formed. That's what the Silk Road was about. If we think about the Middle Ages, we think about the plague and the Crusades, and it was not a happy time. But it was also the time when the royal families and merchant houses of Venice and Bruges created the first stock exchanges there. The families that also financed the expeditions of Marco Polo and others in the Silk Road united the West and the East, and you really had intercontinental trade. So you had the first sort of globalization, and now we're experiencing globalization sort of 4.0. Many centuries later, it's the Middle Ages on steroids, basically, is the way I describe the world of today. The other interesting thing, though, is that not only was the world multipolar, but again, as we move into this post-Westphalian world in which you have to think beyond just governments, in that pre-Westphalian world of the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, again, you have to think about cities, you have to think about companies, you have to think about NGOs. It was the Medici family of Florence, it was the Pope, it was knights and mercenaries, we have modern-day equivalents called Blackwater and other sorts of things. All of these, and of course corporations, companies, all of these were very important players in the Middle Ages, and universities too. The great universities of the West, Bologna, Paris, Oxford, were founded during this period, and they too were great centers of learning. They were considered real authorities in their own right, and today again, universities play this role, religious groups play this role, multinational corporations, again, also call their own shots, and everyone is competing in a way as different authorities on different issues. It's multi-layered, overlapping, and highly competitive without one system bringing it together. So I think in these two ways, we're living in a new Middle Ages. That new Middle Ages really needs to have a new diplomatic system, and this book is about that quest to create that system. And there's another analogy I like to use to kind of describe what the world is like today, especially since there are so many young people here, it's one that will be very familiar, and that is the term massive multiplayer online game, MMOG, like World of Warcraft, right? Everyone logs in, millions of people are in fact logged into any given game at any given time, forming different alliances and coalitions and competing with each other in different pockets and places. Diplomacy is the world's largest massive multiplayer game today. And I think that's actually a useful metaphor. And in fact, bringing up the cyber analogy reminds me to make sure to address the question of WikiLeaks, and I'm sure you're going to have a very interesting discussion about it next week. When the WikiLeaks scandal broke, a lot of people said, this is the end of diplomacy. I heard it quite a few times, I'm sure you did too. It reminded me of an episode, and I go to some length to reconstruct this in the introduction of this book, because I've heard that before. I wasn't around, but it was in the 19th century, in the year 1848, Lord Palmerston in London and Whitehall received the first diplomatic telegraph from overseas. And he said, my God, this is the end of diplomacy. Why would you need diplomats if you can have, you know, cables? And then, fast forward 100 years, and I mentioned this as well, then our national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in the Carter administration, said, you know, with my subscription to the New York Times, I don't need all these embassies and diplomats anymore. They're not producing reporting nearly as good as the journalists in the New York Times. So diplomacy has always been in this race against technology, always, for centuries and centuries. And people have always counted it out. They've always said you just won't need it anymore in a world of universal information or in a world of WikiLeaks. And yet you do. Because WikiLeaks, sure, it creates a whole new level of transparency around things. It creates suspicion. It creates a need, obviously, for diplomats in certain quarters and certain issues to work ever harder to preserve secrecy. But it doesn't eliminate the need for negotiation, for communication, for dialogue. All of those things are going to take place. My argument is that you actually need more diplomacy, not less diplomacy, in a world where you have more diplomats and more actors on the stage, on the scene. And again, no silver bullet kind of solution is really going to work. The G20 is not going to capture that. It's not going to regulate it. It's not going to be satisfactory to all of the players. But now, interstate relations, interstate diplomacy, what happens in our embassies, what happens in our relationship with allies, such as in Europe and elsewhere, is still very, very important, obviously. It is still central. But I no longer privilege it as this central architecture, and everything else, it's just cute, frilly stuff on the side. I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why. Some of the foremost issues on the global agenda today that you discuss here in the World Affairs Council and elsewhere, look at where they came from. Who put climate change on the global agenda? Would we be having all these summits if it weren't for the decades of lobbying from the bottom up and sideways by scientists, NGOs, and conservation groups and so forth? They pushed on that for a very long time, and then it got very high on the agenda. Look at human rights. If you look at the way in which human rights is dealt with in the international community of states, you would never be able to censure a state for human rights violations because the United Nations is a club of states and it is premised on national sovereignty. So therefore you cannot violate that sovereignty and interfere in the affairs of a state. So hence you have a situation where Libya or Zimbabwe or Iran winds up chairing the Human Rights Council, such as has happened in recent years, because states don't do that to states. They don't diss states in those committees. Therefore, you have to have Amnesty International. You have to have Human Rights Watch, because if you didn't, no one would fault the Chinese for what happens in Tibet. You would just have muted silence. Or you would have Gordon Brown saying, maybe I won't go to the opening ceremony of the Olympics, as if the Chinese care. So without NGOs, you wouldn't have that very high agenda. Now let's take one that you're all very familiar with as well, microcredit. Where did that come from? I don't remember the World Bank edict that said, let's all have microcredit now around the world. This is the path to poverty alleviation. No. We know the story of the Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh and other experiments in that part of the world, and how those spread, like virally, best practices going sideways from one country to another, to another, to another. And now, just about everywhere in the world, even the United States, you have microfinance institutions and microcredit. So to me, some of the most important issues of our time, some of the most progressive solutions to problems that we're seeing in the world today are coming from the bottom up, not from the top down. They're coming from outside of the government sector, from corporations and NGOs. But I'm not trying to create an either or kind of situation. It's not governments or companies. There are a lot of people who say, let the market rule, let the market solve all the problems. Well, we know where that's gotten us when it comes to our financial situation, right? You have to have rules, yes. You have to have enforcement, sure. You have to have regulation, of course. But what happens, the solution I'm trying to advocate, what I call mega diplomacy, is where .gov, .com, .org, and .god, never forget the religious actors and groups, where they come together, where they create a division of labor. Division of labor is one of the most important concepts in sociology from Emile Durkheim. And the division of labor is about understanding whose resources are most appropriate, creating that segmentation in society. And that is something that we can achieve today because we have NGOs that have capacities that governments don't, a presence on the ground that governments don't. We have companies that have wealth and resources and talents that governments don't. And it's about bringing those together in the right combinations to solve the problems that we have, and that's what I call mega diplomacy. So we still have interstate relations. But we also have public-private relations, and there's so many examples of that that you literally cannot count them anymore. Public-private relations. Let's take in climate change. You could have another big global conference Kyoto, then Copenhagen, then Bali, and then Cancun. You could have another one. And you could fly lots of diplomats there and burn lots of emissions, and all of those 747s getting there, and surprise, surprise, you would not have a breakthrough on those negotiations. Instead, you could have various governments subsidize technology companies in Silicon Valley and in Europe, and they would develop the kinds of innovations that industrializing countries, Brazil, China, India, need, and you would subsidize and transfer those technologies to those countries at the municipal level with mayors, factory owners, and so forth. And then you would actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and you don't need to have a big conference to do that. You have telephones, you have technology, you have investment, and you have that knowledge flow. That, to me, would be the right kind of public-private partnership. And we're starting to see that happen. And you find that, again, it's not either or, but it's both and. And there's a group called the Joint U.S.-China Chamber on Clean Energy, for example, and that's exactly what it does. It takes Chinese money, puts it into American companies that bring the innovations back over to China, and then they get the mayors together, the factory owners, and they actually implement these things, and they actually help reduce emissions in China. Now, China is never going to go to any of these summits, and it's never going to say, yes, we commit in a legally binding fashion that by the year 2020, 2025, we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. They will never do it, even in the year 2025. They won't do it until they have the technology to do it, until they know they can actually achieve it. And the only way they're going to get that is through the private sector. The private sector innovation and government paying for it, and then NGO watchdog groups making sure that it's implemented. It takes a role for everyone. And we can certainly see similar dynamics in a whole host of other issues. I haven't mentioned public health yet, for example, but just look at the Gates Foundation and its leadership. It would be easy to say, oh yeah, we have this global health system, right? There are governments, they have health ministries, they have their networks of hospitals, there's a World Health Organization, it creates a certain regulatory framework around what global health should look like. Nonsense, right? In the real world, in hundreds of countries in the world, there is no such stable architecture. People are dying, diseases are rampant. Who is actually treating them? Well, the Gates Foundation, which is misunderstood in a lot of ways, actually outspends many governments in the world, and it actually subsidizes the budget of the World Health Organization. So that state entity, that intergovernmental organization known as the WHO, gets 40% of its annual budget to operate, to survive, to exist, from an NGO, from a philanthropist, from one man, from his foundation. Just so that you see the interconnections across this, the public and private divides. And then what it does is, it goes out to countries in Africa, like Botswana, a country that it practically saved from extinction, a country with the highest AIDS infection rate in the world at the time. The Gates Foundation, the pharmaceutical company Merck, and the government of Botswana teamed up and said, how are we going to reduce the AIDS infection rate in this country? And they each had a role to play, vaccine development, and delivery, education programs, and so forth. But the Gates Foundation was intimately involved in this, and now they've turned the tide on AIDS infection in Botswana, and they're doing similar things with polio and other diseases all across Africa. That would not have happened anyway. You cannot say that we have an international system that's tackling these problems, and these other efforts, such as what citizens groups do and civic groups do, are just kind of filling in the gaps. The gap is bigger than the system. That's why we have a world of so many crises and so many problems. Everyone has a role to play beyond just what you think may be happening behind the scenes. There is nothing happening behind the scenes in so many of these issues. And the more you travel around and the more you explore the real world of diplomacy, and the more you can read WikiLeaks cables and see just how banal traditional diplomacy is and how little problem solving they're doing and how much hand-holding and protocol they're doing, the more you realize, my God, this is like an empty building, an empty suit, that traditional diplomacy. So mega diplomacy, to me, these coalitions of actors that are really tackling problems one by one. And it's not just soft issues like climate change or public health. Some very hard issues related to terrorism and so forth. Let's take terrorism before I sort of wind down. With The terrorism, you know, we have been in Afghanistan now for almost 10 years. Al-Qaeda is still a global movement, and you still have terrorist attacks all across South Asia and the Middle East. A military approach to foreign policy is important to do certain things, to take the Taliban out of centralized power, but it doesn't take us out of Afghanistan anytime soon, because all of those other things that mega diplomacy requires to succeed and stabilize that country so that we could eventually withdraw haven't been in place. So now, let's fast forward to today and how mega diplomacy is starting to take hold in Afghanistan. There is a program in the Department of Defense called the Office of Business and Stabilization Operations. So instead of now just moving around with military elements attempting to conduct operations in a country in which they're spread too thin, DOD now has military officers whose job it is to get American companies to go to Afghanistan, and they're taking them to villages and districts and towns and saying, do you think you could invest here? Do you think you could open up a factory here? Do you think you could create some jobs here? How about building this road here? Without companies, without investment, without job creation, the country will never, ever stabilize. The whole economic piece has been missing for so long in the strategy. Then there's the role of civil society. How long do you think it would take for us, the US or NATO, to build a competent, from scratch, Afghan education health ministry that would deliver hospitals, and clinics, and schools to the 20 million people, 10 million children in Afghanistan? Probably forever. Looking at the track record of the country, looking at the corruption of the country, and so forth. Instead, though, Save the Children, CARE, Oxfam, others have been building schools, which they do at far more efficient and less cost than the U.S. government or other government agencies. And they also train locals. They hire locals. They put them in the schools much, much, much faster. They have way more people on the ground. Unlike traditional diplomats who are often confined to embassies, they go outside the wire, quote unquote. They really operate and live among the people. So I think that, you know, it is in the process of allowing these actors to go in and do the good things that they can do, but also helping to build local capacity at the same time, that we're actually ever going to resolve it. But you see in the case of Afghanistan, that epicenter, in a way, of political instability and where it's from which terrorism has emanated, that you have to have a multifaceted approach that involves not just the government and the military, but all sorts of other actors as well. This is why so many people celebrate the work of Greg Mortensen, whom I've met quite a few times, and I'm a big fan of, because how is it that in this underdeveloped, deprived part of Pakistan, so little state presence, government presence has been there? No schools of any kind, certainly not for girls. So he went and he did that. And now village after village wants to replicate his schools. The government still isn't doing it. So he has to raise money from school children. He has a foundation called Pennies for Peace. Operates in thousands of schools across America, and they raise funds in order to be able to expand their projects. The demand for Greg Mortensen's schools through the Central Asia Institute that he runs out of Montana far exceeds the supply capacity that he has to actually build them right now. But where was the government in all of this? Where was the government of Pakistan? Where was the government of the United States? Nowhere. And they're still not. They're still learning from him, trying to replicate that model. Another good example of bottom-up. And one more example that relates to terrorism and the Middle East, because it's about education. The United States has never, for the last 10 years, been so unpopular across the Middle East, right? Because of the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and so forth. And yet, in exactly the last 10 years, who is it that has expanded their presence in the Middle East? Georgetown University, Cornell University, Texas A&M, right? Everyone's got a campus now in Doha, in Abu Dhabi, somewhere in the Persian Gulf. How did that happen? I thought they hated us. Doesn't every magazine cover tell you that they hate us? Well, obviously that's not really the case, because they may not like what our foreign policy has done, but they want American universities, they want American companies, they want American NGOs, they want America, they love America, actually. But they love the things that we are bringing to them, and education is certainly one of them. So American universities are highly popular there, and now that these campuses have been open for a number of years, you can actually see some studies that have shown that it's really changed the way the rights of women in society over there and the way political values are shifting and so forth. So you can talk about democracy in the Middle East for decades, right? I mean, the whole last decade we did do that, but we didn't really sort of deliver it. And yet the way in which we are starting to make change in those countries is through something that's just so simple and actually never cost the U.S. taxpayer a penny, which is having our universities open their campuses overseas. So, you know, two final points that are derived from this. One is that our foreign policy is so much greater than just what our State Department does, what our military does, what our government does, what Washington does. America is the single most globalized society in the world. Remember, we are on the other side of the world, physically. I spend most of my time outside the country, so I suffer through long flights all the time. I'm painfully aware. Anytime I want to go somewhere, I have to fly 7, 10 to 15 hours to get there. We're on the other side of the world of troubles, and yet we are easily, by many orders of magnitude, the most generous society in the world. Our citizenry, the charitable donations that we make, the amount of investment that our companies put into developing countries all over the world, the role of our universities, and so forth is absolutely profound. Far more than any other country in the world. And a lot of that goodness comes from outside of Washington. So to me, I mean, I'm really out to redefine what people think of when they think of the word, when you hear the term foreign policy. I do not think immediately of the State Department for all the time that I actually spend there working with people in the administration about how to do things. Instead, what I tell them is, you're never going to get much bigger budget than you have, especially given our fiscal situation at the moment. So how are you going to make the most of it? How are you going to make a genuinely American foreign policy? Well, it's not going to be by saying, please, Congress, give me another $20 billion of aid money. They're not going to get that. But what they could do is spend a lot more time reaching out inward into America and leveraging all the good things that American NGOs, companies, and others do. And now, I think the proof that this is the right line of reasoning is that they're finally starting to do it because they don't have tremendous resources. So instead, they're organizing technology delegations in which the State Department, for $100,000 instead of for $100 million, can, if nothing else, get 100 CEOs to get on a plane and fly to the Middle East and go around country to country and invest and to create technology centers and education centers and things like this. That costs very little, and yet again, it delivers a lot of good. And that's exactly what the people over there want. So I encourage in Washington officials to think outside of Washington and to draw upon the strengths of America to create a genuinely broad-based American foreign policy. And that's going to be ultimately what improves America's standing in the world, America's image in the world, and keeps us competitive with other rising powers. Because when we put our best foot forward, whether it's the innovative potential of our companies or the intellectual prowess of our universities and things like this, that's when people are touched by America. That's why there's a saying that Peace Corps volunteers are America's best ambassadors, because they work on that P2P level, in a way, not just the G2G, government-to-government level. And then the second thing that flows from the example of universities in the Middle East is the emphasis on youth and dialogue among youth. And so much of what I'm saying, I hope, and we'll find out in the Q&A, is really intuitive to Generation Y. And I think this is probably the only book out there that has a section titled Generation Y's Geopolitics. Because every generation does have a different worldview. And so I think that Generation Y, for members of Generation Y, there's an inherent realization that you're engaged in diplomacy when you operate internationally. You don't have to take the Foreign Service exam and become a Foreign Service officer to be a diplomat. You can work for the Gates Foundation and be a health diplomat. You can work for Oxfam, you'll be a development diplomat. You can work for Google promoting software overseas, and you're going to be a freedom of information diplomat. There are a lot of ways to be a diplomat, and I think that it is a good thing to think beyond just the narrow channel of working for government. As important as public service is, we have to redefine and question what is the word public. The public isn't just what the government does. It's simply acting responsibly. And I think that young people have consciousness of that in ways almost like never before. And I think that to harness that intuition. And that is ultimately what I hope, within the lifetime of Generation Y, will pull us out of the Middle Ages, the new Middle Ages, and into a new Renaissance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And as our tradition, Anika Din from Plano East has the question. And it is, what is your opinion on the crisis in Egypt and the Mubarak government?
Great question. Very timely. You know, in my last book, The Second World, I had a long chapter on Egypt. I spent a couple months just roaming around, and overall almost 7 or 8 months in that part of the Middle East. And I wrote, that was 2005, 2006, and I said, Egypt is ripe for revolution. The exact words are right there in the book. I mean, when you travel around these countries and you see the degree of political alienation, economic disparity, lack of investment in infrastructure, and obviously a horrendously corrupt government, eventually it's going to reach a tipping point. Now, no one can know exactly when such things are exactly going to happen, but you certainly shouldn't be surprised when it does in a place like Egypt, which is the most populous Arab country. It's also a country, though, where with 30 years of dictatorship, you have a very strong hand of the military. So what we're seeing happen right now is that the military is not really willing to negotiate with the protesters, with the opposition movement, and is rather just sort of biding its time and hoping that they'll all sort of go away. In the short term, they're not going away, which is a testament to people power. But the way the country is run is really a lot like Venezuela or like Pakistan, where no matter who is in front, the military is very much behind the scenes in charge. So I think it's going to be a while, at least till September, when you formally see Mubarak step down. Even if he does sooner, the military will still have that very strong hand. Only in September can you potentially have, through an election, the kind of overhaul of the parliament where you would be able to rewrite the constitution. And this is the main point that I want to make about Egypt. Don't stop being concerned with Egypt just when Mubarak is replaced by a guy who, like al-Baradei or someone, although it won't be him, but someone who speaks good English, seems like a palatable face. If you want a better country, if you want a better system in that country that doesn't repeat the same mistake, you have to change the constitution. The problem isn't just Mubarak. It's that country, like many other strongman republics, is a place where the executive branch, the president, has too much power. Until you change the constitution, so the prime minister is more powerful, so you have a parliamentary system, and the executive powers are curtailed strongly, you will absolutely just be recreating the same crisis. It's far too easy to say, out with one bad guy, in with someone who dresses better, or something like that. That's not good enough, because that person will be susceptible to the same abuses as his predecessor. And this I've seen all over the world, even in countries that we think of today as being more progressive than Egypt, like Ukraine, or again in Pakistan. These are places where the constitution is just a chessboard, basically, for manipulation among the key elites who play a game of musical chairs to occupy the top spot. So you really have to have and push for constitutional reform in Egypt. And again, there's another important point about U.S. foreign policy. We never did that. Yes, there have been political prisoners who we wanted released. Yes, we wanted them to have free and fair elections. But we never, in 30 years, said, why don't you have have a parliamentary system? Why not have a stronger prime minister? Why not have a stronger cabinet? All of these, never, why not an impartial justice system? All of these things that really could have made a difference in Egypt's political evolution, we never pushed for. And that's what we always have to be attuned to.
Question from the audience, and I may ask you to wait for the microphone because we're podcasting. Thanks, Dennis, and you, sir.
So what policy should the U.S. adopt towards strongman republics like Egypt, like Cuba? Do we engage by trade and at the same time contrast for reform? Do we do sanctions like we have in Cuba and no interaction or some combination of the two?
Well, as a general rule, sanctions don't really work or are counterproductive, or, you know, there's really no such thing as smart sanctions that only affect the government but not the people. You know, we're not really good at that kind of scalpel-like sanctions policy. Doesn't really get us anywhere. Look at the oil for food program under Saddam and how many people perished under that. But Saddam just hoarded everything and made himself stronger. And in Cuba, of course, the Cuban population remains sort of suffers while the government has still been there and outlasted 6 or 7 American presidents. So sanctions and isolation don't really work in a world that where you have where even if we try and sanction Iran or Syria. Well, Russia, China, India, Turkey, they're also going to trade with them. So really, the effects of our sanctions are more or less nullified. So I strongly advocate direct engagement with these countries, even with Iran, because I really don't see us, with the current policy, actually stopping other countries from investing there and doing business there and keeping the regime afloat. Therefore, it may sound good in principle that, well, we're the ones sanctioning them and we're the holdouts, but we're not really changing anything. And I'm ultimately just concerned with that. Are we changing something there or not? And so I think that if we were to engage with Iran on everything, yes, on the nuclear policy, negotiating with them, stopping their nuclear program however we can, whether it's with Stuxnet or even targeted strikes or stopping blocking shipments into the country, we can do those things. But that doesn't mean that we can't also have an embassy there, that we can't have investors go there and students go there, that we can't build relationships within the society, that we can't even try and strengthen the opposition in different ways. We can do all of these things at the same time. And Iran is an interesting case because, quite frankly, if you look at where it is on a map, there are very few countries that are harder to isolate than a country that has so many neighbors, that has so much energy that could flow in different directions, that whose oil and gas a lot of countries want. It's really going to be hard to convince even Europeans to do it. They're really very half-hearted about these sanctions because they want Iranian natural gas. And the country to Iran's east, one of the two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, both of them actually need Iranian energy. They need electricity and so forth. These are two allies of ours, Pakistan and Afghanistan, that are energy-starved. And we have made it one of our policies that we want to support the people. We want economic growth and development in those countries to keep them afloat, to keep them from falling apart. Where are they going to get that from? They're going to get it from Iran. They have to get it from Iran. Our Iran policy runs directly counter to our Afghanistan policy and our Pakistan policy. So there are difficult trade-offs in the world, and we have to make them, and we have to basically do away with a 30-year-old policy that's very unproductive. So I think that in general, in dealing with these regimes, just isolating them alone and saying, "Oh, we can't. We're not going to let you travel to London." That's not going to cut it. We really have to go within to change them, and you can only do that by engaging with them.
And a question here.
Yes, sir.
Could you just wait for the microphone, please?
What changes would you recommend to the UN to make it a more effective organization?
It's a great question. The UN isn't one thing. Very often in American foreign policy discourse, it's an all or nothing thing. Either the UN is with us or it's against us. But in fact, the UN is a broad set of dozens and dozens of different agencies, some of which are political units like the Security Council or the General Assembly or the Secretariat, and a lot of which are functional agencies. Such as the World Food Program or UNICEF or the High Commissioner for Refugees. That latter group of entities, the functional agencies, they actually do something, right? The Department of Peacekeeping Operations. They put people on the front lines in conflict zones, they feed the starving, they run refugee camps, they educate people, they vaccinate millions of people every single year. I celebrate those agencies. They're largely quite efficient. They're cost-effective for us. We're not the only ones who pay their bills. Lots of other countries do as well. And because they operate on such lean budgets, they're also the best at forming the kind of public-private partnerships that I advocate for in this book. When disaster strikes in Indonesia or Haiti or something like that, the World Food Program borrows offices from IBM to set up their logistics centers. They contract with Coca-Cola trucks to get goods and food delivered. They partner with all sorts of companies and NGOs to actually do their job because they don't have the money on their own. They're forced to conduct smart mega diplomacy. Some of the other groups, like the Security Council, you know, I'm not so sure what genuine utility they have. It's a very illegitimate body because it's not representative. It's a very inefficient body, even with just 15 members, because of the veto function. And of course, the five permanent members, including us, are the five largest arms dealers in the world. So there's the decreasing amount of respect for the legitimacy of the body. I mean, it may be the repository of international law, but as I say, you know, it doesn't stand in the center of my moral compass. I'm not nearly as interested in reforming the Security Council as I am in strengthening the African Union. Because we should live in a world where every region can solve its own problems, where we're not global cop, right? When there's a need for a peacekeeping intervention in South Sudan or Darfur or Somalia, I don't really see why we should be doing it, because with a much smarter diplomacy that's focused on devolving power and authority and resources, the African Union would do it. And we do provide money to the African Union. We could do more. The Europeans do, and they could do more as well. We should be training African peacekeepers. There are lots of them, and they should participate in African missions led by Africans to solve African disputes. That's what I would like to see. I'd like to see the same thing in Southeast Asia. I'd like to see the same thing in Latin America. I'd like to see the same thing in the Middle East. There should be an Arab League peacekeeping force. They should be the ones in southern Lebanon, and they should be the ones in Palestine. So I think that we should be really empowering regional institutions, which are every bit as legitimate as global institutions like the UN.
We'll take one more question after this. Sorry, Joss.
Thank you, Brock. You talked about a lot of various institutions. How about the religion and the religious organization? How do they fit in and what can they do or what are they doing, good or bad?
Yeah. I mean, as I say, you know, I think that very few books about diplomacy would really even bring them in, because books about diplomacy typically just talk about governments. But for me, like I said, the dot god is an important part of world politics in a number of ways. First and foremost is obviously the role that they play in identity. People have many identities. It's not just your nationality. Your religious identity plays a role, even your generational identity, your corporate identity, who you work for. Your whatever Facebook groups you're a member of. People have many different identities today, and religion is an important one. Second is, of course, in pushing certain agendas. I mean, religious groups play a major role in certain conflicts, either in causing them, but also in resolving them. You have so many interfaith dialogues today, which is an important layer of diplomacy today. You know, I've been at a lot of these conversations and conferences with the World Economic Forum hosts, where they bring together religious leaders from different faiths, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and so forth, you know, from places like Sarajevo or Cairo or Istanbul or Jerusalem, to really talk about how they can bring their communities into more peaceful relations with each other. And I think those kinds of projects are not to be dismissed as hopeless in a world of, you know, sort of ethnic or religious tension. I think that there are many good local examples that are already underway, that are already getting money from religious groups to try and create that sort of, you know, interreligious harmony. So I think they're very important that way. Then, obviously, as charitable actors, the humanitarian relief that many religious groups provide all across the world obviously can't be understated. It's in the billions, tens of billions, and more of dollars. And of course, it's boots on the ground. It's volunteers, religious volunteers, who go and work in the trenches in a lot of places to spread, you know, sort of good works and so on. So I think religion is extremely important in all of these ways, and it's only getting more so. I think one important thing to point out is that people, when it comes to Islam, for example, this identification of a global Islam or with a global jihad and global terrorism, I think that's all kind of a myth. Obviously, there's lots of terrorism in the world that cloaks itself in the name of Islam, but there is no such thing as one unified global Islam, just like there's no one unified global Christianity. not everyone in this room or not everyone who's Christian, obeys the Pope. And there isn't even one single central Islamic figure anyway. And on any given day, Morocco and Indonesia and Saudi Arabia don't coordinate their foreign policies. So there really isn't a global Islamic policy or voice or anything. And we shouldn't create one, because that if we did, it would probably be in opposition to us. And that's kind of what one of the mistakes of our foreign policy has been, is to sort of elevate this notion of religion and try and make it into something unified when it really isn't. And that was a wrong policy and a wrong language to pursue. Most terrorism, in fact, is local. 99% of all terrorism is local. It's about Kashmir, it's about Afghanistan, it's about Iraq, it's about Palestine, Sri Lanka. Those are local, political, on-the-ground grievances. Those aren't about global Islam battling global Christianity. No such thing is really happening. On the ground, it's about, why is it that we are disenfranchised and all the subsidies go to those people? Why is it that this bit of land has been seized from us and given over there? Why is it that the government is not representative? Look beneath those sort of big media headlines, the reality on the ground, and you'll find that religious conflict isn't really religious at all.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.